What should we be eating to boost our fertility? Today, we unpack all things food and fertility with registered dietitian, nutritionist, and popular author of the book Real Food for Pregnancy and Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, Lily Nichols. Lily and Lisa Hendrickson-Jack, the author of The Fifth Vital Sign, teamed up to write the brand new book Real Food for Fertility, and we talk all about what to eat for female and male fertility, what's wrong with the Mediterranean diet, some of the things that surprised her during her research, and so much more. Let's dive right in. Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
But first, a moment from our sponsor, the best skin healing product that I've ever come across. Active Skin Repair is a skin health company that makes natural, non-toxic medical-grade sprays and gels to help support skin healing by using something called hypochlorous acid, which mimics the natural healing response that the body uses itself. Very intelligent and an absolute game changer for a huge variety of skin ailments, including burns, cuts, scrapes, bites, rashes, stings, eczema, acne, and more. I highly recommend carrying a bottle in both your bag and your car. I use it on my baby, my dog, and my acne-prone skin. It's such a smart product, and we think you will love it. Head to activeskinrepair.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 20% off your order.
I have the honor of interviewing Lily Nichols today. Lily is a registered dietitian, nutritionist, certified diabetes educator, researcher, and author with a passion for evidence-based nutrition. Her work is known for being research-focused, thorough, and sensible. She is the founder of the Institute for Prenatal Nutrition, co-founder of the Women's Health Nutrition Academy, and the author of three books, Real Food for Fertility, co-authored with Lisa Hendrickson-Jack, Real Food for Pregnancy, and Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. Lily's best-selling books have helped tens of thousands of mamas and babies, are used in university-level maternal nutrition and midwifery courses, and have even influenced prenatal nutrition policy internationally. She writes at lilynicholsrdn.com. All right, Lily, I am so excited for today's episode. You are such an inspiration to me, being in the space of naturopathic medicine and nutrition and fertility. And it's amazing when people like you can create all of the research in this beautiful, succinct way in the books that you've created. So thank you for the work that you've done in the world.
Thank you. Yeah, it's an odd superpower of mine. I was just talking on another podcast about, like, they're like, wow, how do you like keep track of all the things? I'm like, you know, I just look like that crazy meme of the guy with the hair all, you know, flying everywhere with the bulletin board, with the picture of this attached to the string, with the picture of that. Like, I'm basically that guy. Like, that's my brain. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then at some point it gets to the point where I like organize it all to make it cohesive, but that's where I spend most of my time.
I love that. I feel like you and I are very similar in that way. I feel like I also, the way that my brain works is I can take really complex things and pare them down and teach them in a way that people really love. And it's like my favorite thing to do. Even, I mean, I love being a doctor as well and in doing that with one person, but I also love, you know, educating and sharing to the whole group. So yeah, I think that's amazing. And the work that you've done and the books that you've created have really changed so many people's lives. So it's awesome.
Thank you.
Speaking of that, many of the followers, if they don't know you, or if they do, they probably know about your Real Food for Pregnancy book, but you have a new book, which is Real Food for Fertility. And today we're going to talk about fertility and then some things about pregnancy. To get started, was there a reason or an inspiration behind writing the fertility book? Like, how did that come about?
Well, other than my first book, which I just felt compelled to write because I was tired of hearing misinformation about gestational diabetes.
Yeah.
The other two books have kind of come by request. So this one as well, you know, with Real Food for Pregnancy, it was hey, do you have a book that's like not all about blood sugar? Because I feel like this also applies to pregnancy. I'm like, yeah, yeah, just apply the stuff in the diabetes book. And then I was like, okay, it actually does need its own book. You have to like recover from each book for before you dive into another big project. With Real Food for Fertility, I mean, certainly there's so much research on how preconception health plays into pregnancy outcomes. So not just the conception part, because that's a lot of times where the fertility conversation ends, is just pregnant and that's it. But a lot of pregnancy complications stem all the way back to preconception health. So I had long thought about, you know, this might be an area worth exploring. And then my colleague, Lisa Hendrickson-Jack, her and I were actually book buddies when we were writing our other, when I was writing Real Food for Pregnancy and she was writing The Fifth Vital Sign. So I learned all sorts of things about the menstrual cycle from her. And we're like, you know, we really should do this together, because there's certain topics that, you know, I can write in much more detail on the nutrition part and she can write in much more detail on the menstrual cycle. And we're like, we should really team up on this. And so, yeah, it was many years in the making before we even started to work on it. But it felt like it just really needed to be written. We also felt strongly that almost all the resources on fertility are only tackling the female component. They're not talking about male infertility.
Yeah.
Lisa had long, she actually had started writing a book on sperm quality and male fertility. She was like, you know, this could just go in this book. So we consider it almost like three books in one, because you have like the nutrition part, you have like the menstrual cycle, timing sex for conception, issues with birth control part, and then you also have the sperm quality part. I mean, we have a chapter on both sperm quality and egg quality, as well as so much more. So it feels like three books in one, and that's part of why it's such a long book and such a detailed book. And as you know, fertility is just a reflection of your overall health. So it kind of turns into an overall health book.
I know.
So many topics you have to go into to like, to give due justice to the topic of fertility, that it's just like, well, it's kind of everything, right? It's like
your diet
and your lifestyle and your cycle and your sleep and your exercise and all of the things.
Yeah.
So yeah, it kind of, it sort of stemmed organically, but people have been, you know, everyone likes to give me their requested book topics. And this was this was the one that I was like, I think I could bite this one off now. And I don't know if there will ever be any other books, because it's so much work. But we're happy with the outcome.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad you did it. I know fertility is so big. I have courses, and like some of my big bundle courses around fertility, I've broken each like pillar of fertility into a mini course, because there's so much to say. And like my fertility formula is 13 mini courses, because you have to talk about investigating fertility and about egg quality and about sperm quality and about diet and about toxins and about detox. I mean, it's like, there's just a lot to encompass it. Fertility is actually really complicated. I mean, it's simple in the sense that when we are healthy, we should be fertile, right? Like that's, that's the simplicity of our biology. But it's unfortunately not simple in today's world anymore.
No, it is not.
And it's sad. And, you know, when we look at the world of preconception, I love preconception because I feel like it's such a powerful time that we can influence so much. When we get into infertility, like when I have patients who come to me who've already been trying for a year or two or three, it's challenging if they haven't worked on their lifestyle or their diet, because oftentimes there is intense metabolic imbalance or a lot of microbiome issues or detox stuff. And it's the hardest place to be, because you want a child yesterday, yet there's not only one, but two people in front of you that we need to break down their entire everything, right? And so I just, if I could scream at the top of my lungs to the whole world, it's to focus on preconception, to get to people before they have been trying for years and years to conceive, because there's so much that we can shift. So let's talk about that. What would you say are some of the like more shocking things that you found in your research, or interesting things around the preconception and prepping for fertility stage?
I will say, There's so many angles that I can take this. No. So let me think here for a minute. I think, so with my history of working with women with gestational diabetes, I mean, I've just focused with basically everybody on blood sugar management because it's so important.
So important.
I found it, I don't know that this was surprising, but I think it's worth saying here that blood sugar balance also plays a big role in fertility. And beyond just there is overt diagnosed insulin resistance or prediabetes, but even blood sugar levels that are slightly suboptimal but don't quite qualify you as prediabetic, are associated with delays in conception. It takes longer for pregnancy to be successful. And then even those slightly suboptimal levels are associated with a higher risk of certain issues with the pregnancy, not just like the gestational diabetes down the line, but even like congenital heart defects and neural tube defects. We see those at higher rates with suboptimal blood sugar. So some parts of the like research process were like, oh yeah, duh. And then other parts were like, wow, I'm surprised there's even an association with even slightly out of range blood sugar levels. So that part, yeah. Key, I guess that's kind of the opposite of what you were asking for.
No, it's great. I mean, and we see blood sugar playing a role in male fertility too. I don't know how much you know story, but male fertility is like my biggest passion because that's, we have male factor infertility. My husband and I, we had to do IVF due to it. So it's a huge passion of mine. So I'm so glad that you guys are bringing attention to it. It is so underserved in the fertility space.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And
the sperm quality chapter was nuts.
I know.
It's super long. That was one of Lisa's primary chapters. I came in on all the nutrition components on all the chapters, but like that was her like, you know, baby.
Yeah.
And I was like, Lisa, this is too long. There's too much research. We need to simplify. She's like, oh, I know. I have this in here. And
I know.
Ultimately the end result is really, really good, but it's a complicated topic and one that almost nobody is talking about. So
yeah, I remember when, you know, our story is really long and complicated and a lot of people who've listened to our podcast know it, but for those who don't, you know, we tried for almost 6 years. I found out my husband had very little to no sperm during medical school, during my sperm analysis class. So that was like a very unexpected thing. And so I went down the path of researching and learning everything I could about male fertility. And I don't know if life had happened a different way, maybe I would have written a book about it at some point. But I remember being in the male urologist's office, one of the top urologists in San Diego. And I asked him, I had read all the research on all male fertility. And I had asked him just to see what he would say. Is there anything men can do to optimize their sperm? I just want to know what he would say. And he's like, no, you could maybe take a Centrum vitamin, but really not really. And I was just blown away because I had read all the research. I was like, I could have brought in a stack this thick of all the literature.
Right. That there is so much. There is so much more research on sperm quality than there is egg quality. It's easy to get a sperm sample, right?
And it just made me so sad. And it's why I'm so passionate about even people who have to go through reproductive technology. The men are completely being ignored and they don't care at all about sperm quality, even if you have to go through IVF. And it's one of my biggest gripes because, like you teach about with preconception, the epigenetics of the eggs and the sperm impact the embryos and your babies. And it's like, just because you can pull a sperm with tweezers and stick them in the egg, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have optimized the man's sperm.
Totally.
Diet lifestyle. So it's one of my biggest, like, I just want to like shake the whole industry. It's just so frustrating, but I'm just glad that there's resources because there weren't a lot of resources, you know, for what to do for men.
And one like interesting factoid, if I could just build on that a little bit, is that a lot of pregnancy complications actually have their origin from something going wrong with the formation of the placenta, the like how well the placenta kind of invades the endometrial lining, the vasculature of the placenta, right? We think about preeclampsia being so that's very much related to the placental health of the placenta. but the placenta is formed from embryonic tissue. So it has both partners' DNA in there, but it more highly expresses paternal DNA than maternal DNA. Wow. And so this is why there's really strong like correlations with preeclampsia, for example, and like issues with the man. There's super interesting research on this where you have like a man who's had babies with multiple women, and maybe those women had already had babies before having babies with him, but like every child that he is responsible for, the pregnancy results in preeclampsia. But outside of that, the other pregnancies that the woman has, these three women, no preeclampsia. Like there's this male factor involvement in the health of the pregnancy too, not just like the genetic quality of the sperm and like the epigenetics of the baby, but also the trajectory of the pregnancy itself. So yeah, it's so important that we have that conversation. And it's also sometimes, I mean, your partner may be different, but it's sometimes hard to get men on board with making diet and lifestyle changes. We're always thinking about the nagging girlfriend or the nagging wife who's like, stop drinking so much beer. And like, you know, like I don't want to offend any men who might be listening, but we also want them to like take this seriously too. And sometimes when the information comes from an outside source and not the partner, it is better received, because then it's more like, yes, you're right. You did learn that interesting thing from the book, which I've been telling you about for 3 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And wait, I'll support you with it, right?
I know. It is really hard. The male side, I have patients with both. I have female patients who their partner is never involved, doesn't care. It's like so hard to get them to do anything. And that's frustrating. And then I have other patients who they're super on board and they're like motivated and they'll do anything that we say. And that's awesome. But I would say the majority is not that. And we just have to change the script. I just think a lot of men don't think that they play much of a role at all. And I think if they could read the kind of data that you share in the book, they see how powerful their role is and how, you know, and I always tell my male patients, I'm like, ideally you make these changes and stick to them forever, you know, these like lifestyle and healthy life changes, but really like focusing on the preconception time, you know, a woman's job continues, right? She's right. Pregnant and then she's breastfeeding and, you know, all of this stuff. But I'm like, I know it feels hard to give up alcohol or to, you know, eat a certain way, but if you can just do it for a few months, it can make a huge difference. It's not like you can't ever drink your beer.
Okay, 3 months.
I know. So I think when you frame it like that, people can be like, okay, I can do that. Because if you tell someone like you can't ever eat this thing again or whatever, that can feel really scary, especially to a guy who maybe, you know, it wasn't like they made the appointment. They're like, I'm really excited to get pregnant. But it is, it's an obstacle. And so, yeah, I'm really glad that you created that resource. And speaking of male fertility, let's just chat a little bit about that. What are some of the things that you learned in your research? Like if you were to be at a barbecue talking to a friend and they're like, what should my husband do? Like what are kind of some of the lifestyle or food, especially food things that you saw for male fertility?
Yeah, well, first, before even the food part, I would say making people aware that the guidelines for what is considered normal sperm are set really, 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 really low. It's like the lowest fifth percentile of men who are fertile, capable of getting a woman pregnant. So it's a really, really low threshold to rule out like pretty overt infertility. But there is this sort of gray area of subfertility where maybe your sperm quality count, morphology is not quite optimal, and that is associated with delays in conception. So you can conceivably, you know, you can conceivably, pun intended.
Unintended. I was gonna say, great pun.
You could. That was an accidental one, but it was a good one, right?
That was a good one.
Your partner could get pregnant, but it might take a while. And whereas if your parameters are optimized to a higher level, the conception is more likely to take place a lot quicker. So I think that is one area where I just have to mention that before going into any of the what to do, because I think that shocks people. If they even get to the point that they do get a semen analysis, and that sometimes takes a lot of work with the conventional medical system to get them even willing to check it.
Yeah.
A lot of times they're just told that it's fine because they're looking at this very low threshold. So first and foremost, that needs to be stated. And there are, we have tables in that chapter showing, you know, infertile, subfertile, and like optimal fertility ranges. So if you do get a semen analysis, get your full lab results and actually look at it and see, is it really fine or is it maybe not quite fine?
Yep.
But as to what to do, I mean, interestingly, there's a lot of overlap between optimal nutrition and lifestyle choices for female fertility and egg quality as there are for male fertility. So you don't really have to be doing a whole lot different. As a whole, blood sugar balance is huge. You don't want to have high blood sugar and elevated insulin levels. So getting your carbohydrate intake in check, choosing higher quality carbohydrates over the processed refined stuff vastly improves your nutrient intake, but also prevents these huge blood sugar spikes and crashes. Better quality fat consumption. We know having a high intake of like omega-6 fat, low intake of omega-3 can affect sperm quality. It essentially drives oxidative stress, and anything that is driving oxidative stress and inflammation, generally speaking, is not so great for sperm quality.
Right.
And then I would also add, and this gets a little controversial, and we can dive into it if you want, but getting enough high quality protein is vital. And a lot of the research on fertility we found was pretty biased against meat, which doesn't really make sense because anybody like yourself who's working in practice, you see firsthand that if people are under consuming protein, especially high quality animal protein, you got issues with fertility. Especially more prevalent. You see it easier, I think, in female fertility. If you're monitoring their cycles, you could see the cycles get completely thrown off when they're not eating enough protein. Men, it's like, unless you're doing a semen analysis, that might be hard to see. But there's so much bias in the research against meat. And yet meat is rich in a lot of these nutrients that support optimal sperm quality, like
carnitine. I mean, I have creatine. I have my own theories about that because I used to work with a lot of vegan patients because my first practice was in Southern California. And it's like shocking how much, you know, not getting enough calories, not getting enough protein, not getting enough high quality nutrients impacts everything from energy to your menstrual cycle. And also with men, I had, you know, male vegan patients too. And I think so much of the research is done on really crappy, poor quality meat. And I think when you actually look at it, they're not getting grass-fed cows, you know, or high quality, you know, wild-caught fish. Usually it's just they're looking at, you know, meat consumption, and you probably know this even better than me, but as you know, there's so many other factors in poor quality meat. And when it comes to sperm, like you mentioned, anything that causes oxidative damage, if you're consuming a really low quality, you know, meat product that might have a bunch of herbicides and pesticides and other chemicals, and it's, you know, their profile is they're fed corn, so they have a lot of arachidonic acid that's inflammatory. And there's all of these other components that are potentially impacting the sperm. It's not necessarily the meat or the protein or all of that. And they just don't tease that apart. I see that so much in the nutrition literature, and you know it probably more than me, is they never, or they're very rarely ever, tease apart good quality anything from bad quality.
No, that is not done. And on top of that, you think about it, there's the healthy user bias sort of thing that comes into play, where the people who are serious about their health obviously are limiting the amount of meat they eat, because we all know meat is killing us, right? So you have the people who are consuming the most meat are often the ones who are consuming the most ultra processed foods, the most deep fried seed oil laden French fries and stuff, drinking the most alcohol, smoking cigarettes, doing all these other things that are not necessarily health supportive. And so that can skew the research. There's even, like, in some of the studies that are talking about dietary patterns, they have identified one meat and French fries in a lot of the studies, right? They're not just having the beef burger itself. You're getting the bun, which is made with garbage ingredients usually. You're getting the ketchup you're dipping it in. You're getting the soda on the side. You're getting the French fries. You're getting the dessert that comes afterwards. And so we can say meat is bad, but it's is it really the meat or is it these other factors? And what I found interesting when I dove into some of this stuff, not to get us totally off track on the sperm quality stuff, but I feel like it needs to be said, is that in the studies where meat was not necessarily identified as a problem, or maybe in some cases was associated with benefits, like some of the studies, the men who eat more meat, especially organ meats, actually have better semen quality parameters for most of the parameters they're looking at, or in women associated with better ovulatory function, they won't talk about that in the results. And so sometimes the actual text of the article does not reflect the data.
Yeah.
If they put the data in a table with all their odds, ratios, and whatever, you can look at it and be like, wait a minute, this whole study, like the title of the study says plant proteins are beneficial for fertility, dot, dot, dot. And then you look at the table with the actual data spelled out and you're like, wait a minute, beef performed better than two of these different plant proteins that you put in here. Actually, weird. The like soy meat replacements performed like worse,
horribly,
far worse shocker than any of the animal protein. Like, what? But that's not the title of the study. It's not in the abstract. It's not in the discussion. It's not in the conclusion. It is not written about in the paper. They just want to like bury any results that could show anything positive with meat. So that was actually one of the things, if I had answered your first question more succinctly, that was the thing that I was probably the most surprised about. I wasn't shocked because I see this bias all over the place, but I was surprised at how blatant, I mean, it's basically a cover up. I mean, you're not talking about your findings at all. You're completely glossing it over. So that I found really frustrating because that's the same thing that I've seen in practice. Same thing Lisa's seen in practice and pretty much all of my colleagues is that some of the worst reproductive outcomes we actually see in the clients who are most restrictive in their animal food consumption, for many, many reasons, but at the very basic level, you are not intaking the raw materials for hormone production. And we see that in poor egg quality, menstrual cycle disruptions, and you know, delays in conception, and then semen quality and low testosterone and all the things. So that is like a major elephant in the room that people don't want to talk about. Everybody just wants to be like Mediterranean diet.
Lots of grains. Oh my gosh. I know. I feel like once you get into the world of truth, you realize how you have to go against the mainstream in every way and how biased research is. And, you know, I think people forget that research is expensive to do and someone has to pay for it. And they don't realize how much our science, quote unquote, is bought and there's agendas and there's, you know, all of these things. And so, you know, people like you who can sift through it and actually read through the data and actually pull the truths without some like hidden agenda is super rare. And that I think is why your books are so profound and why they're so helpful, because so much of what we're fed through marketing and through society and through the news isn't necessarily the truth. It's what they want us to think. And, you know, I think about this with fertility in relationship to toxins. You know, if they really cared about the environment, if they really cared about anything or anybody, they'd be banning phthalates from products. They'd be taking fragrance out of things. I mean, they clearly don't care. Like there's somebody with deep pockets who has influence, or they just, you know, don't have that conversation because it's not like we don't know. The data is so clear and it's just shocking. And, you know, from food and toxin perspective, I think are two of the biggest things that are really contributing to this high rate of infertility. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And what's ironic about the whole thing, a lot of these, I mean, some products, you know, some things are kind of unavoidable, right? I think about plastic tubing and like the medical world, you know, but you think about clean home cleaning products has to be the biggest sham industry scheme of all time, because you actually don't need the vast majority of those cleaning products.
I know.
I mean, You really don't. It's funny. We had somebody coming to help clean our house at one point. She's like, where's your, you know, naming all the products.
Yeah, and
like,
where's your surface cleaner, your window cleaner, your floor cleaner?
Exactly. I literally spray down counters with like vinegar. Some essential oil in it. And I mean, I do have dish soap. We do have laundry detergent, the cleaner versions, but like, I don't have chemicals because they are not necessary.
I know.
And yet people have cabinets full of just carcinogenic, highly fragranced, who knows what it is.
I know.
What an industry. I mean, it's brilliant when you think about it. You get people buying these, each one is a $5 to $10 product, and then you're replacing it every couple months. But what a sham. We really don't need that.
It's a huge sham. Vinegar is amazing. We use it all the time. And it's, So that's my recommendation, as anyone who knows me talk about, if you're like overwhelmed by all the nutrition and lifestyle stuff, one of the easiest things that you can do is just get the chemicals out of your life by looking at fragrance products and cleaning products, right? Especially air fresheners, plug-ins, like those things are the first to go because they serve zero purpose. Yeah. And you know, the data is super clear on that.
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. I want to talk briefly about Needed's Fertility Support Bundle. Needed is the company that I've helped formulate their prenatal and many of their fertility products. And because we're talking all about fertility today, I just wanted to share the powerful supplement support that you can get through Needed. We're talking all about real food with Lily and how something as simple as eating a high quality protein breakfast is key for fertility. But we also need key nutrients, and there are many things that is challenging to get in our modern day diet due to soil quality, our dietary preferences, and the needs of preconception and fertility. This is where supplements come in. Needed's prenatal is obviously one of my favorite because I helped design it, and I think that it is the best on the market as far as the nutrients included and the dosages. If you are in the preconception or fertility phase of your journey, I would highly consider checking out Needed's fertility support plan because this has the six key products that you need to really boost egg quality, to optimize your hormones, boost your nutrients, and do all of the things that are optimal before conceiving. The six products that it includes are the prenatal, their omega-3, their pre and probiotic, their egg quality support, their CoQ10, and their collagen protein. These all play very important and specific roles in supporting eggs and your hormones and fertility. So definitely think about checking that out. If you want to learn more, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER. Okay, back to the show.
So I want to talk more about those kind of things, but let's back up to protein because I want to chat about fasting and intermittent fasting. That's such like a popular thing right now. And what is your opinion based on what you saw in the research on that, especially with women? I have my own thoughts and feelings about it working in practice, but what would you say to someone who is trying to get healthy and so they're not eating in the morning or restricting calories? What would you kind of say to that in the fertility space?
So I think we need to approach intermittent fasting with a lot of caution when you're in the preconception window. I think it's really tricky because the internet is full of all sorts of success stories with intermittent fasting. There's a lot of positive data on it for many different things. But it can be done in a way that is just overtly a disaster for fertility. And I think that is the most commonly done way, is that people approach intermittent fasting with a goal of losing weight. And it's not just that you are limiting your eating window, you are also combining it with caloric restriction. And when you have those two things combined, hormonal disruption, menstrual cycle disruption ensues, and it happens quickly, often within just a couple of months. So the majority of women that I see doing intermittent fasting are doing it from that angle. Goal of weight loss, calorie restriction, and eating in a shorter eating window. There are very few studies that are done on women specifically. Most of the intermittent fasting research is done on men. However, there is a, I would say there's one exception to my, like, I don't think it's a good idea for fertility. And yeah. that is, and we don't have a ton of data. It's a small trial, but there was a trial on women with PCOS, insulin resistant PCOS, at a heavier BMI, right? And they had them do intermittent fasting, but instead of the delaying breakfast or skipping breakfast angle, they had them eat between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. And they also made sure that they didn't restrict calories. They gotcha. Had them keep their calorie intake pretty much the same as they did before. Mm-hmm. And this intervention was dramatically beneficial for their hormonal balance, their metabolism, weight loss, fat loss, specifically androgens, all the things improved for the majority of participants. Again, it was a fairly small trial, but nonetheless, I think this highlights that it can be done in a way that's beneficial. At the same time, there's other research on PCOS where it's not a time-restricted eating thing, but they simply front-load the food, like a larger breakfast, moderate lunch, small dinner, versus gotcha. The other group got a small dinner, moderate lunch, and large, small breakfast, moderate lunch, large dinner. And the ones who had the bigger breakfast, even with everything else kept equal, just swapping which meal was the largest, they had like the best improvements in their PCOS by far. So I That's think you amazing. Can kind of, you could take that information either way. I mean, I think trying to eat a dinner before 4 p.m. would be a little crazy, especially if you have a family. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you don't have any kids yet, maybe it would work to do a shorter eating window, but again, not skipping breakfast. Or you could take it from the angle of just front load your food with a large high protein breakfast, and you probably can expect fairly similar benefits.
Yeah. I love that.
As a whole, you have to be cautious, like really cautious with intermittent fasting, because again, if you do it from the breakfast skipping angle, most people just end up under eating as a whole, just across the day. Even studies that are not specifically looking at intermittent fasting, but just breakfast skippers.
Yeah.
They don't eat as many calories. And from a hormonal standpoint, it's kind of a disaster for your blood sugar, your insulin, your cortisol, your adrenals are just not happy when you're not having breakfast. So I'd rather we get the food in fairly early, particularly in the women who are already prone to under eating. It's just not great to intermittent fast in the morning. And if you want to have a slightly earlier dinner because you're satiated and you've had enough food, great. But don't skip that first meal. That's really where I see the most menstrual cycle disruptions and fertility issues, hormonal issues start, is with under eating and specifically skipping breakfast.
Oh my gosh. Yep. You said it perfectly. That is what I have experienced in practice so much. Like I said, I had a lot of vegan patients, a lot of intermittent fasting, you know, all of the trendy things, especially in
California. I grew up in Southern California, so yeah. I get it.
And totally. At least in my practice, the number one thing across the board was under eating. And the majority of what I did with patients early was getting them to eat breakfast. And it's just so crazy to me how I, you know, personally experience that, because I have to do take a lot of steps to keep myself in balance. I'm very sensitive. And I always, you know, you just intuitively, once you start learning your body, realize how good you feel when you eat a high quality, high fat, high protein breakfast.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just one thing to tell somebody, but I would always try to do experiments with people so they could feel it.
Yes.
And I love salmon for breakfast. I know not everybody can get behind that, but salmon or leftover dinner. And I would have my patients do a challenge where I'm like, okay, I know this sounds crazy because you're used to not eating or having a smoothie for breakfast, but just try a week of eating, you know, high protein, salmon, leftover dinner, whatever, for just 1 week and see how you feel. And it's like amazing the transformation that I would see in women and how their energy and their mood and their anxiety and all of these things in such a short amount of time that they embodied that for themselves. And it's like, I didn't have to tell them anymore. They wanted to do it because they felt so good. And I just, yeah, if that's the other biggest scams of cleaning products and the Western culture's breakfast is a huge scam.
And on top of that is if breakfast is consumed, it's usually a garbage breakfast.
Exactly.
It's high carb blood sugar spike, mm-hmm. which leaves you feeling like crap. Like, what, this is funny. One of my earliest blog articles, it's gosh, over 12 years old now, is called The Healthy Breakfast Mistake.
Yeah.
So whichever angle you take it from, whether it's skipping breakfast or eating an imbalanced breakfast, because you really have to flip the macros on its head. It's the cereal for breakfast, the fruit for breakfast, the oatmeal for breakfast really is a metabolic disaster for most people.
Yep.
I think sometimes you have some athletic people where as long as they're putting in protein with it, like they can handle the high carb because they're burning so much energy. But for the rest of us, it's kind of a hot mess. And
yeah.
it's funny you say that you do that because I did the exact same thing in practice.
Yeah.
Every single client I've ever worked with in my entire career, I can say this like very strongly, we had to fix breakfast.
Yes.
Breakfast was a mess, whether it wasn't consumed or imbalanced.
100%.
And that was the number one thing where if we didn't fix breakfast, nothing else went to plan. We had to fix breakfast, and it was the first thing we had to do because that's the only way to get the hunger and fullness cues in a good place. It was the only thing that was going to get their blood sugar and insulin in a healthy place. It didn't even matter what the goals were. It's like we always had to work on breakfast.
I know. And you know, when people ask, what can I do for fertility? I think people are really shocked to hear things like go to bed early, eat breakfast.
I know.
You know, like these things. Yeah. But when you think about it, when you understand the physiology, you know, the foundation of our hormones are our daily hormones, right? Our cortisol, our melatonin, and they are the foundation of then our sex hormones that happen each month that dictate our ovulation and everything about our fertility. And you have to start at the base. It's like a triangle. You have to fix the foundations, and the foundations are so unfun to talk about, but they are it. You know, people want the fancy supplement and, you know, how do I fix my egg quality and all this stuff? And sure, they have a place, you know, certain supplements here and there, or even trendy foods. But it's really like the day-to-day practice of what you do every day, what you choose to eat, when you choose to eat, how you go to sleep, that are very unfun to talk about, but that is the medicine. That's it. That's how you do it.
I know. The supplements are all bonus.
Yeah. So speaking of that, when a woman is thinking about optimizing her fertility in the preconception phase and is wanting to support egg quality, on top of balancing blood sugar, optimizing breakfast, getting high protein breakfast, what are some of the other foods that you would recommend to someone to bring into their routine to support their hormones or egg quality?
Lots of things, many of which are of animal origin. So apologies in advance to the vegans listening. But eggs with the yolks. I mean, we need to bring up your fat and protein intake first and foremost. And it's kind of interesting, like regardless of which issue you're working with, there's almost like I often put, this is like not accurate because there's so many possible reasons for fertility challenges, but some of the most common are PCOS and hypothalamic amenorrhea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Each one, there's a totally different approach nutritionally, but at the same time, sufficient protein and fat are foundational for both camps, even though we're working on different things and approaching it from a slightly different angle. So you need the protein and the fat consumption for that sort of metabolic stability, stabilizing the blood sugar and insulin levels. You need the fats for the raw materials for hormone production. And then of course the foods that have protein and fat together, which I mean, most of them are animal foods, are also our most micronutrient dense. So they have your iron and zinc and choline and B12 and vitamin A and, you know, the whole long list of things in there, which have documented significant benefits on egg quality, endometrial health, menstrual cycle regularity, like all the things, IVF outcomes. So I'm often looking at it from, you know, from that angle, whether you're taking it from the macronutrients angle or you're taking it from the micronutrients angle, you kind of end up in the same place, which is we need to include more high quality animal foods. So the eggs with the yolks, meat of all kinds, nose to tail. So You don't just eat the steak or the chicken breast. You also incorporate the organ meats. You also use the bones to make broth. You don't take the skin off the chicken and throw it away. You eat it, or you save it when you're making broth. But that whole like nose to tail thing gives you a wider array of micronutrient intake, particularly if you're including organ meats, but you also get a better amino acid balance by including some of these collagen rich cuts and the bone broth and all of that. Fatty fish and seafood is huge. There's a number of micronutrients in seafood in particular that are trickier to get from other foods, that are very supportive of hormone balance, detoxification, egg quality. So our iodine, our selenium, our DHA are some of the top ones. But if somebody's not eating much of their other animal foods, seafood may be filling a really important gap for a number of other nutrients as well. High quality, full fat dairy products. There's some very interesting research on dairy infertility where, you know, lower fat or non-fat dairy products are not necessarily associated with better fertility or better IVF outcomes, but the full fat ones are.
And what about raw versus pasteurized?
We write about raw milk in the book, chapter 3 of Real Food for Fertility. So if you have access to raw from a reliable, clean source, we're all in favor of that. It tends to be much more digestible. You have certain nutrients and enzymes and probiotics and things that are better preserved in raw milk than when it has been pasteurized.
Yeah.
Even still, the majority of the data on dairy and fertility, looking at these associations, it's just any old dairy products, right? They're not separating out organic, grass-fed, raw, unhomogenized, and all that. Even still, even conventional full-fat dairy has these better associations, which must have something to do with the fat itself, the cholesterol probably, and then some of the fat-soluble vitamins. Like we know vitamin A is so absolutely vital to hormone production, and maybe something to do with like the riboflavin in there. I mean, that's in the non-fatty component of the milk. We know riboflavin is really important for methylation, for folate metabolism, which plays a role in every single stage of all the things from preconception through conception, pregnancy, and so forth. So yeah, our dairy products. I do like to include some fermented foods for the probiotic microbiome benefits. That plays a whole role in, I mean, all the things, nutrient absorption and bioavailability, detoxification, immune system health, oxidative stress. And then not to have everything be mostly animal foods, but some produce as well. I know this has even become controversial nowadays. I'm like, when would fresh fruits and vegetables become controversial?
I know.
But I've now lived long enough that fruits and vegetables are controversial. It's not that you have to consume every single type if one of them makes you not feel great, right? If you're somebody who needs to avoid tomatoes because it flares up your joint pain, I mean, do whatever you need to do. But as a whole, there are micronutrients in produce that are beneficial. And there is a role for fiber in our health as well, especially the fiber coming in from fresh produce versus some other sources. They're very helpful for your microbiome. They're helpful for your body excreting like excess, used up, no longer needed estrogens and other metabolites that your body's trying to get rid of. When our body is processing toxins, some of them are excreted via our bile into our digestive tract. And unless there's something for it to bind to, and fiber is a really great binder, a lot of that ends up getting reabsorbed. So it is possible there can be too much of a good thing, but generally speaking, fibers coming from produce are highly beneficial for fertility and overall health. So I do see a role for them in the diet as well, on top of the high quality animal foods.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and the one thing I like to highlight too, because I personally am just not a fan of extremism in either way, you know, veganism or carnivorism, because I just feel like there's a role for lots of different foods. And in egg quality and sperm quality are the phytonutrients and the antioxidants that some of the, you know, deeply colored fruits and vegetables have. And so you want to incorporate those too. I imagine them as like the shields, you know, to protect against the oxidative damage. And so having all of that high quality nose to tail animal products, and then having the produce for the fiber, but also for the phytonutrients and the antioxidants, because if you don't ever have antioxidant consumption, that's not good either, in my opinion. So I feel like it's all needed, right? Like the whole spectrum of food is like your medicine cabinet, and they all play a different role.
And I didn't even highlight, you know, all the foods, because people would be like, well, what about root vegetables? What about grains? What about this? And I'm like, there's a place literally for all the foods. It's just, I'm like highlighting the ones to emphasize.
The most important, yeah.
Look at the meal plan so you could see, like, we do incorporate grains and starchy vegetables and stuff like that into the meal plans, but they are not usually a thing that I need to like hold people's hand to be like, eat more of these foods. Most people are eating plenty of those foods already. Totally. And we need to like work on the balance or work on, you know, reducing the fear around consuming animal foods or consuming fat. So I'm highlighting some of the most nutrient dense, but this does not mean that you're only going to eat vegetables and fruit and meat, right?
Like
that has its own issues, I think, for a lot of people. Primarily, people end up under consuming calories, right? Like you have the people who are so extreme leaning towards the orthorexic side of things that they're not eating enough food. So,
Yeah, I love that. I actually had a conversation with a friend the other day who's trying to conceive, and I didn't know, because she's not my patient, she's just my friend, I didn't know that she was lifting heavy 5 days a week and has been worried about her weight. So she hasn't been like eating as much and all these things. And it's just like, it's just so funny because it seems so basic. Like you would just think if you're trying to conceive that you would be eating more, but it's just not a part of our culture. It's not a part of our mindset. And I had to really relay to her, evolutionarily, our body needs to know that you are so nutrient dense. You have so much extra to give to another that you're, if you're in a state of deficit, the body's really intelligent. And it's like, well, this is, you're living in a famine and you're clearly running from a bear every day. So this is
to conceive.
And so I think for women, just really shifting that mindset of this is the time that if you're, you know, you don't want to be obese. We obviously see obesity plays a role in fertility struggles, but this is the time to really like nourish yourself with tons of extra nutrients, because your hormones want that supple, you know, I'm really well fed feeling. And that's what's fertility. And it's so opposite of diet culture and of, you know, if you can see a six pack on a female, I'm like, how could you possibly be pregnant? Like you have no body fat. And it's really challenging to conceive that way.
It really is. And it's very interesting, like looking at some of the like anthropological data that's been written up about different cultures. And I actually write about that, I think, in either the intro or chapter one of Real Food for Fertility, how when you look at some of these cultures, there were seasonal birth rates, kind of like how we see, you know, deer have their babies a certain time of year. Like that same thing was observed in some of these, you know, traditionally living human populations where conception and pregnancy would take place at the time of year when food was most abundant. And then during the periods, there's even a study, a quote where they said, when thinness had taken us, you know, like you would not be ovulating or menstruating anymore, and you wouldn't be able to get pregnant. So it followed kind of a seasonal, you know, there was a seasonal fertility cycle. We don't see that nowadays because food is around us all the time. But interestingly, we have such a high proportion of women with hypothalamic amenorrhea where they're just it intentionally forcing a famine upon themselves. And, you know, reproduction is an optional function for your body. It is the first thing that your body is going to turn off when it has any indication that there might not be enough resources. It's the first thing that's going to go. If that's what's going on, you know, you're skipping cycles or your luteal phase is getting shorter or your period is really light. Some people kind of like they're on the cusp of HA, but they haven't quite lost their cycle, but they live in that in-between zone with like a really short luteal phase, super scant menstrual cycle, kind of weak, you know, signs of ovulation, very low cervical mucus production. They can live like that for years, just on like, just on the brink. Just on the brink of the cycle disappearing. But that's not optimal, right? Because when your luteal phase is too short, you don't have sufficient progesterone. It's going to be a lot of work for your body to try to ramp up enough progesterone production to, you know, keep a pregnancy viable. So there may be multiple times where it's like, I think I might have conceived, but super early miscarriage because they just don't have the progesterone production. They've got to eat. Yeah. So it's wild how common that is, but it's shockingly, shockingly common. And I think diet culture has a lot to do with it. We have this really unnatural expectation of thinness, or this appearance that like adult women are going to look like 15-year-old girls forever. Like your body does change when you get older, and like that's okay and expected. So
And so many ancient cultures, the statues and the depictions of fertile women had roundness to them.
And
no one was like these teeny tiny little sticks, you know, with abs who were like pumping out babies. It's just that maybe you were a warrior, but you definitely weren't the breeding female in the group. But I think that perspective is so important. And I wish we had more, I don't know, reverence and more respect for a fertile looking female. You know,
absolutely.
I always tell people the, you know, big boobs and long, thick hair and long nails, these things that women identify as quote unquote attractive, they're all signs of nutrient sufficiency. And yet women don't have long nails, so they get fake nails, and they don't have long hair, so they get extensions, or they get boob jobs and all of these things. And not that anything's wrong with that, but they're, what they're doing is they're trying to create the illusion of I'm fertile, essentially, which means I'm well fed. I have so much extra nutrients that my nails are growing, that my hair is growing, that I have all of this fat tissue. And so why not, you know, try to encourage women to eat so that they actually have those things?
That's a fascinating perspective. I love how you put that.
Yeah.
It's true though.
And lashes, you know, long lashes, there are signs of estrogen. You need to have fat to have estrogen. You have to have, you know, these animal products, these micronutrients to make these hormones, to make all of this excess sign that we just know evolutionarily are signs of fertility.
Right.
It's why the, you know, we're attracted to that. Even though we don't think of that, it's not like I'm going to get my nails done because someone's going to think I'm fertile, but that is what the evolutionary.
As I look at my nails and I'm like, my nails are so, I've always been one of those people where my nails just grow crazy. Like, my nails are
you're
long.
Well,
I really need to cut these right now.
Same, but that's a sign of excess. And, you know, cause women will come to me in practice even, and they'll be like, I really want, you know, thicker hair or longer nails. And it's like, okay, what's going on with your thyroid? What's going on with your estrogen?
Right.
And at the end of the day, these are all rooted in nutrients.
Totally.
And so, yeah, I just like throwing that out because I think we forget that culturally that is a sign of being well fed. So let's actually just feed ourselves instead of starve ourselves.
It seems like it doesn't have to be so complicated. But,
no, I know.
You know, I find that it's funny. We went from like the sort of thin ideal, stick thin ideal of like the 1980s and 1990s. And then that slowly shifted to this, you know, muscular ideal where you have so many women who are working out so hard. And I get that some really do, like they love their sport and athletics is like their expression and it's awesome. Women can do everything, right?
Yep.
But at the same time, that comes with really high demands for fueling yourself. And if you're looking at what a female athlete actually needs, I mean, sometimes they need close to double the amount of calories of someone else. And what I often find is among athletes, especially, I mean, this is so well documented, the whole female athlete triad, but so many women have swapped the thin ideal for the muscular ideal, but they're not fueling enough.
Yep.
And then you also have issues with fertility. It's like there's this very fine balance, you know, we need we need a Goldilocks amount of food and a Goldilocks amount of exercise. And like, that level is going to change based on your activity level. And it seems silly that here I am, you know, all these years later, still having this same conversation about fueling enough, but it really is.
I know. It's so common and it's so complex. And that's where fertility is fascinating. You know, I always, when I started practice, I was like, I'm going to do the hardest, most complex cases and see all these autoimmune diseases and all these neurodegenerative stuff. And then I just didn't have as much passion for that when I got into practice. I was really drawn to preconception and fertility. But now, after being in it for so long, I realized, oh, fertility is the most complicated.
Yeah, right.
You know, in today's world, because there are autoimmune diseases that affect fertility, there are metabolic issues that affect fertility. There's then the mental emotional component where we're teaching people, you know, how do you teach someone that toxins affect fertility, but not have them freak out and feel so scared that they can't go out into society? How do we find these Goldilocks, these happy mediums? And, you know, there's just so much to teach because you're basically trying to teach someone how to live a healthy life, which should be default. Right? It should be default in our culture. And instead, it feels like it's the complete opposite of that. And so, I don't know, I'm really excited. And it's also frustrating being a professional in the fertility space when you go to conferences and stuff, and the only thing they talk about is the Mediterranean diet. It's like,
You know, we wrote all about the Mediterranean diet in the book.
I did buy the book, but I haven't read that part. So, but I've always been intuitively like, what?
Let's chat about the Mediterranean diet, because that is one of my most annoying, this is one of those sections where, you know, Lisa and I debated on it and I'm like, you know what? Everybody's going to ask, well, you're talking about all this meat and all these animal foods, but what about the Mediterranean diet? That's the best one for fertility. Everybody knows. I was like, we have to write about it.
Yes. Okay? Please tell us a little bit about that.
So the frustrating thing as a whole, before I even get into the fertility part of the Mediterranean diet, is the fact that the Mediterranean diet was first identified as like the dietary pattern that we think of in the West as what it is, something that emphasizes, you know, cereals, vegetables, fruit, low-fat dairy products, olive oil, nuts, wine in moderation, you know, fish, legumes, and limited meat consumption. That was at first defined by Ansel Keys. We know Ansel Keys as the guy behind the Seven Countries study, the one who created the whole diet, lipid, heart hypothesis. I'm probably getting those words all mixed up. But he's the one who really essentially set the foundation for our low-fat dietary guidelines. He did some flawed Seven Countries study and associated dietary fat intake with cholesterol levels and risk of heart disease. And therefore, saturated fat and cholesterol intake from animal foods is bad and everything else is good. And also here's this Mediterranean diet. When you look at where he did his data pulling, he pulled only from the island of Crete in Greece and southern Italy, which has, if you think of the Mediterranean, there's 21 countries that border the Mediterranean Sea. So even calling it a Mediterranean diet is a misnomer as a whole. But even within Italy or within Greece, there's a lot of different dietary patterns there, depending on if you live in the mountains or close to the sea. But he also did some of his investigations during Lent, when a lot of people gave up meat for religious reasons.
What? That's crazy.
And this happened post-World War II. So some of the areas where he was studying, they had been really hard hit by the war, and they were basically in famine conditions. So they had low meat intake because everyone was starving and poor. But once, you know, economic conditions improved, people went back to their traditional diet. So the whole concept of a Mediterranean diet is based on a really shaky foundation as a whole. And that has to be called out.
I love that. I didn't know that. I love history. I think that's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. And I'm like truncating it into a really, really brief description of what was going on there. But definitely you would like this section. Yeah. There's also this expectation that fat intake in the Mediterranean is low. That is actually not true. I mean, think about traditional Italian cooking.
Yeah.
Yes, there's olive oil, but they're also cooking with like lard and like pork back fat constantly. Mm-hmm. There's cured meats They're using yep. organ meats. They, of course, use fatty cheeses. They're not using low-fat. What is it? Low-fat cheese? Yeah. So that concept is actually not true. The switch to doing more olive oil versus animal fats happened after they started mimicking the American dietary guidelines. So that was a more recent shift. But what I find interesting is on the studies on the Mediterranean diet and fertility, most of these data points that we have, and I will say many of them are positive, right? But most of these data points are based on observational studies, not clinical trials. Mm-hmm. Clinical trials where they would like apply a certain dietary pattern head to head with another one and see what happens. Or even better is if it's like a controlled feeding trial where they provide all the food by the study itself, reduce as many confounding variables. But no, most of these are observational in nature. And as a whole, if you take any standard diet, the average American diet, we eat 58% of our calories from ultra processed foods. Okay. If you take anybody eating 58% of calories from ultra processed foods and put them on even an Ansel Keys definition of a Mediterranean diet, you will see improvements.
Right.
You will, because they're yeah. not eating as many processed foods.
Right.
So that certainly is a confounder. But when there have been some studies where they, you know, look at, what about a Mediterranean diet that adds a little bit of red meat, for example, you mm-hmm. actually see better outcomes.
Wow.
You look at what is the life expectancy of people in the Mediterranean? Where is it the highest? It's the highest in the regions that actually consume the most animal foods, the most wow. meat.
Yeah.
So I think we can take some of the general principles of a Mediterranean diet that are healthy, because it's not like what's included is unhealthy per se. It's that they exclude
yeah.
healthy foods simply because they're a source of fat.
Right.
So we could take the good parts, we could take the less processed foods, the more produce, we could take the olive oil and the fish and the legumes, but we can also still eat meat and full fat foods.
Yeah.
And I will also add just one more thing is this, there's an assumption that the Mediterranean diet is really high carb, lots of mm-hmm. grains, lots of pasta. And that's also not necessarily accurate to the region. And we don't necessarily need to put people on a super high carb diet, because that yeah. often can be a bit of a mess for fertility as well, depending on yeah. the person. An athlete may actually, because they've been under eating so much, need a fair amount of carbohydrates, but you have somebody with PCOS, and that maybe is not the best intervention to increase their carbs.
Right.
So I think we can customize.
Yeah.
But I don't find the data to be as strong on a Mediterranean diet than any other eating pattern. It's just that it's often displacing ultra-processed foods. That's,
yeah.
That was my major takeaway.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's so important to highlight. And I just love people like you who have the courage to not just kind of repeat what they see or what they've heard, but to actually dive into the research in an unbiased way and see what is actually going on. And as you know, more than probably anyone, studying nutrition is really complicated. My undergrad was nutrition, and it's just challenging because there are so many compounding factors and there's so many variables. And, you know, you can find a very reputable professional with a book, with everything that you could ever imagine to support every single type of food and discredit every single type of food. And it can get really confusing for people. But my experience clinically and my experience personally, to me, feels like what you teach about and what you've highlighted is really so spot on.
Well, and I think part of that is that a lot of times you have these people in academia who are so siloed into their own yeah. little world that they don't have client experience.
Right.
If you don't have client experience and real world experience, you're going to come up with shitty studies. I'm sorry. Yeah. I just mm-hmm. saw one today on postpartum, which was such a bad study. Oh my gosh. And one of the lines in the study was that, well, these women were not really compliant with physical activity, but maybe that makes sense in the first month first month postpartum because they're prioritizing their infant health over their own. I was like,
oh my gosh,
what is this garbage that I'm reading right now? Right? So I'm hopeful that sort of thing comes through in the writing. Is that I cite a lot of research because I tackle controversial topics where people get pushback. Well, show me the evidence that salt isn't going to kill me. Show me the evidence that saturated fat's not immediately going to give me a heart attack. So I have to back up my points because there is so much pushback when you're doing anything that's contrary to the guidelines.
Right.
And I mean, while certainly a lot is informed by clinical experience, I'm also not just sitting there and like writing all this stuff without looking at data, because there are many times where I'm like, you know, I think this might be the case. And then I look into it and I'm like, oh, wow, that's not the case. It was like 10% that, but like 90% this other thing. Fascinating. Yeah. Like the data informs the writing, but the clinical practice kind of keeps you in check when you read something where you're like, this doesn't make any sense at all, because what I saw in practice is this, talk to 5 other colleagues. Yeah, I saw the same. Mm-hmm. And then you can start to pick apart the methods of the study and be like, oh, this is where it went wrong. Or dive into the data tables and be like, oh, they're misrepresenting their findings entirely. Mm-hmm. Okay, right? But that takes a lot of work, right?
Yeah,
it's time consuming. Most people just don't want to do it.
No,
which I
not
don't
at all.
Blame them.
And even clinicians, you know, who know things don't necessarily have all the time to read all the research, which is why people like you are so valuable to be reading the actual studies. And it's just, I think it's amazing. So I know we're coming up on our end, but I have a selfish question for myself that doesn't have to do with fertility. That has to do with pregnancy. So once a couple becomes pregnant and a woman is in her first trimester, I don't know if you experienced sickness or food aversions or vomiting or any of the things, but that has been my experience both times I've been pregnant. And I just want to know what your take is on that and what you would tell someone like me who has barely been able to eat much at all and has severe food aversions to all of the healthy things. Like what do you say to that?
I impressed that you are showing up and we're talking about organ meats and you have not vomited.
Oh my God. Well, a couple weeks ago, I probably would have.
Yeah. I have 2 kids, so I've been through the first trimester. thankfully did not throw up a whole lot. But that low level queasiness, fatigue, blah. Occasional vomiting, nothing sounds good, everything smells bad. Was real. It's legit. And it's really tough. The hard part about it is I think it's so different for every person. And what I found for me is that it was almost like it changed hour by hour, which things were like, oh, that's off-putting. Do not even talk about it.
Yeah.
So one day I might be completely averse to the idea of eating like a burger. And then the next day I'm like, a burger is the only thing I want to eat. We need to go and get a burger like right now. And that is so tricky because I'd love to just give all the advice. And yet the struggle is real. So from the aversion angle, I mean, first of all, food aversions and nausea tend to co-occur together. We don't know why they happen. It seems like there may be some sort of an evolutionary component from like the perspective of we don't want to encounter a bacteria, virus, contaminated food that could make us sick or risk the viability of the pregnancy. And therefore things that spoil really quickly are off-putting.
Yeah.
Like the animal foods, the meat especially, the fish, which has a smell, off-putting.
So
the vegetables and fruit, fresh produce, also that can spoil fairly quickly. But even more so if you think of vegetables from a traditional, like from an ancestral component, they weren't hybridized to be the vegetables we have of today. So they would be like really bitter and probably have higher levels of compounds that conceivably could have been teratogenic at some point, at some level of consumption. And so maybe it was kind of like stick to the safe foods, like stick to the root vegetables. Like
yeah.
those don't go bad. Those don't have the toxins wow. in them that
That's
the
interesting.
Wild plant has. Like, I think there mm-hmm. might be some sort of a component there. But on top of that, I think a bigger component is that it co-occurs with the nausea, and things that have a smell become off-putting. So my best recommendations, it might be kind of averse to prepare foods yourself, but getting foods that are pre-prepared or having somebody else cook for you or heat it up for you so you don't have to be around the preparation of raw meat or the smell of things cooking, which kind of like doesn't smell that great, could be helpful. I know people yeah. have done, maybe they can handle the raw food, but they put their crock pot in the garage so they don't oh, yeah. smell it.
I've done it all. I haven't cooked a meal in like 3.5 months. My poor husband. I feel so bad. Yeah. But it's interesting what you say about the spoiling, because I am so turned off. So the worst, I'm still sick, but I was really, really, really bad a couple weeks ago. I'm 16 weeks now. Just opening the refrigerator made me vomit. But it yeah. makes sense, because it's like that's where food is rotting in a way.
Yeah, right.
I mean, hopefully not, but you know, it's just I couldn't handle leftovers, especially
oh, yeah.
like I could eat a meal that night, but if I saw it the next day, it's like no.
So and I think that could have something to do with histamine.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. you have higher histamine buildup in leftovers, and certainly some foods that have a strong smell, it's because they're older and there's histamine buildup, and histamine is a super strong nausea trigger.
Yeah, which is interesting, because a lot of the meds that are given to pregnant women are antihistamines.
Antihistamine, exactly. A lot of the nausea meds are antihistamines. And also, if your blood sugar gets too low, that can mm-hmm. stimulate the release of histamine endogenously. So you think about the small frequent meal recommendation to keep the nausea at bay. Yes, it keeps your blood sugar from going as low, which we're more prone to in the first trimester. You're actually more insulin sensitive in the first trimester. So hypoglycemia is very common. Mm-hmm. That triggers histamine. So like the small frequent
that.
Meals of things that are like not strong
not
smelling
yeah.
and not potentially spoiled or not left over for more than a day or two. Like that makes a lot of sense.
That is interesting, because the one thing that I usually can depend on that I can eat in a panic is a carrot. Like I'll get one of those big carrots and just like nibble on it, which makes total sense because, yeah, it doesn't go bad easily.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. I wonder, I don't know if you've looked much into this, but DAO is an enzyme that breaks down histamine in the gut.
Yeah.
And some people don't make it very well.
Yeah.
And I feel like I was looking into some research earlier and then kind of got sidetracked with my own life and didn't dive deeper into it. But a doctor I had met was saying that women who are taking DAO is helping their fertility, it had something to do with like histamine and fertility. And
that
I just,
sense.
I never looked fully into it, and I should. And I'm just wondering if even myself, as I'm sitting here talking to you, if I don't produce a lot of DAO, if
you
if
could run taking, your genetics.
I know. Well, and
Dr. Ben Lynch is working on a histamine like report for your genetics.
He's big on histamine.
Yeah.
He has a DAO supplement, I believe. Seeking Health is one of
He does.
One of the
he
few.
Has that. And then there's also that certain probiotic strains can like help metabolize histamine faster or something like that.
Yeah.
He has one of those too. But yeah, I think the histamine component is a really interesting angle to look at it from. But as far as management with the food aversions, it's just like eat whatever you can keep down. And then from the nausea component, well, interestingly, like ginger is a common nausea treatment. Ginger is also antihistamine. Did you know that?
Interesting.
So
I don't think you knew that.
It's really fascinating. So whatever you can get down. Fullwell recently came out with some nausea gummies that have a clinically proven like 500 milligram equivalent dosage of ginger extract. It's like a tart cherry flavor. And I've just the feedback I've gotten from my audience and friends is that that's been highly, highly effective for their nausea.
Nice.
Ginger, of course, doesn't work for everybody, but yeah. It's tricky. At the end of the day, it's like, why does it happen so frequently?
Know.
Like 90% of pregnant women have some degree of nausea. I don't know if the other 10% are lying or it's just mild enough that they don't think it's there, but it's a challenge for sure.
It is. And it's so hard because, you know, I do a lot of work with Needed. You know, I love Full Well and Needed. Those are probably two of my top favorite supplements for pregnant women. And like, I'm literally right now writing content about, and I did this one with my pregnancy. I helped design their prenatal with my last pregnancy. And now I'm writing a bunch of content for a big project that they're doing all about the nutrients in pregnancy and how important they are as I'm sitting here, like barely able to eat anything.
And
it's hard. It's almost hard to know so much. And I think, you know, I just have to keep reassuring myself that the baby's, I did all that preconception work, right? I was really healthy preconception. And that's another shout out to really having an optimal diet and getting your reserves up before pregnancy, because you never know what's going to happen once you get pregnant.
I can offer some reassurance in that, you know, technically early on, when the embryo implants into the, you know, endometrium, it is nourished by the endometrial glands. It doesn't have a direct blood supply. I mean, technically you have a direct blood supply, but like you don't really have like a direct blood supply from mom to baby until the placenta and umbilical cord and everything is fully formed. And that's like in the first trimester, early second trimester.
Right.
So in that phase, the baby's really relying on mom's nutrient stores in her endometrium, which is why I use the sentence in the book, the healthy menstrual cycle sets the stage for a healthy pregnancy. It's not the only reason. There's other reasons beyond the endometrium, but your actual period blood flow is a reflection of if your endometrium is sufficiently thick to nourish this, you know, brand new life. And that's why with IVF and other ART procedures, I mean, they are monitoring the thickness of your endometrium, right? That is, when it's too thin, they're not even going to bother with a transfer. It's like, it's too high of a rate of failure. We'll try another cycle.
Right. So,
you know, hopefully that gives some reassurance, but I do think the preconception nutrient reserves are one of the most helpful reasons to build them up, is to just give yourself a pat on the back when you're in the rough phase and be like, I did this work ahead of time.
Yes.
I will get back to it when the symptoms allow. And it kind of often is this gradual decline in symptoms and a little bit of a bumpy roller coaster for a while, up and down and up and down. You're probably in that phase now until finally you can start eating like a normal human again.
I know. I can't wait. It's so hard because I'm such a foodie and I teach about food, and food is so important to me. And it's just so ironic. I've had the most ironic motherhood journey.
Yeah, right.
You know, being a natural fertility doctor, having to do IVF, planning a home birth, having a C-section, you know, designing supplements for pregnancy, not being able to eat anything. It's just like very ironic, my whole journey. But I think it has allowed me to have a lot of compassion for women and be able to teach from experience that I maybe wouldn't understand otherwise. So
totally.
I think that's amazing. And just a little shout out before we wrap up, I do have a lot of women reach out to me on how to optimize before IVF. And I think getting Lily's book is probably one of the best things that you can do, because, you know, when we talk about thickening the endometrium, a lot of it is estrogen, right? The estrogen builds that endometrial lining, and you have to have fat and you have to have protein and all of these things to make these hormones. And so just surging yourself with more nutrients. And also I love sharing about when you do egg retrieval, you are turning not one egg into an embryo, but multiple. And the biggest thing I always teach about is how it's like you have one apple and you're giving it to your one child in a natural conception. In IVF, you have one apple and you're giving it to 10, 15, 30 children. So just imagine how much more nutrients you need to make each of those little eggs optimal. So someone going through IVF needs to do even more nutrient support, eat even more nutrient-dense foods than even someone not going through IVF, because you are trying to nurture and feed so many more of your little follicles and egg embryo baby potentials. So that's another little shout out to really taking this work seriously of eating a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've been in the stage that you're in. So hang in there, pat on the back.
Thank you.
You did the work ahead of time. It'll be okay if the only thing that you can keep down is, like, I don't know, grilled cheese and tomato soup.
Ugh, I know. I wish. I actually make this avocado cashew pudding, weirdly, because I know avocados can be high in histamine, but they don't bother me. For some reason, I can eat that, and it's, like, enough fat, I guess, for me to just, like, get through. So that's kind of my, when I'm in a pinch, snack that seems to be the...
It's high vitamin E, it's high vitamin B6.
I know. That's great.
So there's, I mean, that's good. You're doing better.
I know. When I found that, I was like, oh my gosh, it's the only food I've been able to eat consistently, because I've thrown up so many things that I'm just like, oh, I can't ever again do that. Yeah, we'll get there. So for anyone listening who's in a similar experience, hang in there. This has been amazing. Thank you so much for all of your wisdom and knowledge. I feel like maybe I'll have to try to convince you to come back to talk about gestational diabetes, because I think that's another huge, amazing topic.
Yeah.
But maybe even Dr. Morgan will interview you, because she does a lot with pregnancy. But I am so thrilled about your book. How can people connect with you, find you, get your books? Like, tell us all the things.
Well, you can find me at my website, lilynicholsrdn.com. You'll find, my blog has like hundreds of articles. There's no paywall. It's all free. Freebies tab has more free stuff. I have a first chapter, Real Food for Pregnancy, for free up there. Also, if you go to realfoodforfertility.com, we have the first chapter of that book for free over there if you want to take a peek at that.
Amazing.
My books are all over my website. There's a books tab. You can find them there. I teach professional level webinars via the Women's Health Nutrition Academy. I have a more formal, lengthy mentorship program for prenatal nutrition professionals via the Institute for Prenatal Nutrition. You can find more about that on my site as well. And then as far as social media land, you can find me on Instagram. My handle's the same as my site. So it's at @LilyNicholsRDN. I post research, food I'm eating, random
Amazing.
Stuff that never appeases the algorithm over on Instagram.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I'm not very good at the algorithm at all. It's so funny. Amazing.
Well, yeah. If you're good at the algorithm, you're usually doing like dancing reels, which I've said from the beginning, I'm just not doing. So it is
neither.
What it is.
I was like, nope, I can't be inauthentic. And that is not me. So sorry if less people get to see my stuff. I just can't do it. Amazing.
Well, I guess we're old, right? So it's fine. I'm like,
it's just not me. I don't know. Yeah. I'd rather sit and teach, but I know that that's, I don't know. I don't even do that a lot on Instagram, because I'm barely surviving over here. But one day.
You will get through this phase. It too shall pass.
Yes. Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm so stoked. And for everybody, go get her books, all of them. They're all so helpful. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Do you have your heart set on starting a family and are eagerly preparing to begin trying within the year? Have you been actively trying to conceive for several months? Do you have a burning desire to optimize your chances of conception and avoid the distressing path of infertility? Or have you been navigating infertility for a while, yet you yearn for new solutions, a supportive environment, and an approach that addresses the root causes of infertility? Our current fertility system is broken. Many couples receive almost zero support on optimizing their health and improving their chances of conceiving before or while trying to have a baby. 1 in 7 couples end up trying for over a year and then are often shuttled into the medication or reproductive technologies routes like IVF. Though there is a time and a place for these tools, so many couples would have different outcomes if they had the education, resources, and support I provide in my fertility formula bundle. This program is a bundle of 13 mini courses about everything a couple needs to know. Each mini course consists of invaluable information, as well as exactly what to do step by step, with all of the resources I have created over many years seeing patients in practice. From mastering the cycle to boosting egg and sperm quality, balancing hormones, investigating female and male fertility, nourishing the body, fostering fertility energy, ditching toxins, reducing stress, rebalancing the gut and vaginal microbiomes, and detoxing prior to pregnancy, this bundle has it all. This is the information you aren't getting from your regular doctor that will only improve your chances of conception and the health of your future baby, no matter where you are along your fertility journey. and it costs less than one appointment with me. Visit www.womanhoodwellness.com/fertilityformula and use code HOPE to save 15% off the entire bundle. Again, that's www.womanhoodwellness.com/fertilityformula and use code HOPE to save 15%.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.